You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Not long after he came into office in 2009, President Obama issued an executive order that ended torture and other abuses of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. 6 years later, news continues to emerge about the U.S. treatment of prisoners before and after he made that order. One recent report examined the role members of the American Psychological Association played in CIA torture programs. And in a new PBS Frontline documentary, filmmaker Michael Kirk examines the discussions Bush administration officials had over the interrogation methods and later over how to respond to worldwide condemnation. Secrets, Politics, and Torture airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Kirk back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. Although I have to tell you, I found the show incredibly disturbing. How complete a picture do we really have now of how the CIA treated prisoners?
You know, if you know the definition of the term tip of the iceberg, I think we've at least seen the tip now, maybe a little more. There's an executive summary that was released in December, 450 pages, which was, to my own surprise, I know a little bit about this subject, was fairly complete. I mean, their conclusions are drawn from cables and emails and many other items that I actually was surprised that they got into the depth they got into. Sadly, I think if you're a believer, and let's get it all out there and talk about it, there is a 6,400-page document that the Senate investigators have created that is locked up in a safe now in the hands of the Republican majority at the Intelligence Committee, and something called the Panetta Review, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some moment in our conversation today. So a little bit is better than nothing, and the little bit we have is pretty intense, certainly to my eyes, ears, and mind, And maybe it's enough to put it all to rest, but I doubt it.
Now, is what is classified now the details, or do you think that there are still lots of questions about our practices to be answered?
Well, you know, in the as you know, Leonard, we're in the middle of a fight for history here, and the CIA and its and the believers, true believers in the program, excuse me, in Congress and other places continue, even in the face of the release of the report in December, to argue that you know, if people only knew what they knew, they would support the program. So it might be nice to have that 6,400 pages to just see whether that turns out to be true or not. My guess is, from talking to Senator Feinstein and members of the staff who dug into the 6 million pages of CIA documents they had access to, that it's a lot more of the same, and maybe in the kind of excruciating fine-grained detail that it might take to once and for all put the issue to rest on the side of we really went too far.
Should we be surprised? In late 2002, this is pretty early in the story, the Washington Post and New York Times published reports on abusive treatment of suspects. The Post quoted some U.S. officials saying, if you don't violate someone's human rights some of the time, you probably aren't doing your job.
I remember the quote. It was part of what got us started on our film in 2005 about Abu Ghraib and what was happening inside the military side of it.
And Abu Ghraib is what really changed public perception? We weren't paying attention from 2002 until Abu Ghraib?
It depends on the definition of we. I think senators I've talked to, Congress people we've talked to, you know, said they didn't know most of the detail, any of the real details, certainly any of the nitty-gritty details, how people were slapped, punched around, walled, as they call it, banged into walls, and certainly not the details of waterboarding, even in 2006, that part of what started this Senate investigation was the discovery that how little they actually knew by the time the President of the United States came forward in September of 2006 and talked about it in kind of general terms. And even at that hearing, or even at the private sessions around that, members of the Intelligence Committee told us that Michael Hayden, who was at the time the director of the CIA, talked about, you know, there's a thing called belly slap. And he kind of called it tummy slapping, when what it really is a pretty substantial punch to the solar plexus. So even at that level of semantics, I think the members of the Intelligence Committee by fall of 2006 didn't know very much. So, and I found, even as much as I read it, I'm by no means expert in this regard, but I'm at least as knowledgeable as knowledgeable citizens are. I was astonished to spend my December reading the report at the level of detail and the kind of gruesome brutality that it raises.
President Obama said he sees no reason to, quote, refight old arguments. How much of an argument was there?
Well, this is part of the problem, of course. There really weren't, as I've just said, there wasn't much information out there to argue about. I think when Abu Ghraib happened and then when Dana Priest from the Washington Post revealed the black site's existence, those prisons that didn't exist in Lithuania, you know, as far as we were concerned, they didn't exist in Lithuania, Thailand, Poland, other places like that. When those two events happened at basically the same time, I think then knowledgeable people who were against the war, people who worried about what dark paths America might be going down, were really interested, and certainly the Congress was interested, and the participants at the CIA who we interviewed, John Rizzo, for example, who was their senior lawyer for 30, the entire duration.
And he was with the CIA for 34 years.
I think 32, but yes, a long time, and mentioned more than 200 times in the Senate report. Mr. Rizzo, who we interviewed for 7 hours in January, sort of told us that, you know, even they knew that when the Abu Ghraib pictures showed up, although they weren't pictures of a CIA installation, they were military, and when Dana Priest's stories came out, they knew they were in some trouble and it was time to begin to, you know, circle the wagons.
Well, he talked to you. Were you surprised because you tried to talk with Jay Bybee and John Woo and Stephen Bradbury and some other higher-ranking officials, and they all turned you down?
We, you know, over the course of, I think this is our 13th or 14th film about what was happening during the years 2001 to late 2001 until now, over the course of time, of course, we've talked to you and many other people, John, you and many other people, but yes, certainly any of the CIA directors who you would have expected might want to come out and talk about this, they all sort of very quickly, there was a burst of them right as the report came out, essentially saying they didn't interview any of us, they only looked at the documents, this is incredibly one-sided, only a piece together story meant to describe a hypothesis the Senate already has, and no Republicans support it, and this is a hit job. So that was the party line in December, and then thereafter they wouldn't speak, and it took some serious conversations on our part, and I think in some ways the interesting choice by John Rizzo to give us so much time to talk, especially since he was at the center of it all, and then a little bit later along came John McLaughlin, the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who for a while was the director, who himself stepped up and said, you know what, I'll defend what we did. If it wasn't for those two, you know, whatever the contemporary view of the Central Intelligence Agency is wouldn't be revealed. They literally don't want to talk about it in public.
My guess is Michael Kirk, whose latest documentary for PBS Frontline is Secrets, Politics, and Torture. It'll be broadcast tomorrow night. You opened with a clip from the film Zero Dark Thirty. Does that reflect the popular perception of the role that torture played?
There have been, you know, some surveys done that people's sort of popular perception, partly as a result of Zero Dark Thirty, and also as a kind of sort of general understanding that you have to break eggs to make omelets or whatever they always say. There is a kind of feeling that millions and millions of people learned from Zero Dark Thirty that in the aftermath of the killing of Osama bin Laden, that the government intense interrogation program actually worked and yielded the information that they needed, that they required to go get bin Laden. And I know we reveal in the film, reveal is too fancy a word. We say in the film and show in the film that the Central Intelligence Agency was actively involved in a campaign with the filmmakers to make sure that their version of the history of how bin Laden was killed was the version that the film made, and therefore the version that millions of people saw, and the extent to which that impacted the public perception, I think, is pretty obvious.
They provided the director, Catherine Bigelow, with a lot of the material that was used in the script, and then Paramount, the studio, allowed the CIA to review the script for the movie?
I don't know that. I looked into that. I mean, I know that they let them, I know that the CIA let them come into the counterterrorism center at Langley, that they showed them the model that they had built so that they could practice taking him down, going into the building in Abbottabad. I'm sorry to say I don't know about the script approval part of the story.
The PBS Frontline webpage for your film describes your film as the secret history of the fight over the CIA's controversial interrogation methods, widely criticized as torture. Widely criticized as torture? Who at this point disputes whether waterboarding or some of the other CIA methods were torture?
Well, the CIA, for one.
To this minute?
I think so. They were very chary about using the word torture, and
but even Rizzo says that the expression that they use, enhanced interrogation techniques, is deceptively bland.
I know, that's amazing. He says that in his book, which I thought was you know extraordinary, given how careful they are in the semantics of all of this, and how much they disagree. Obviously, torture, by some definitions, is illegal, and for the CIA, for him to say that was, I thought, an interesting admission in a world where every word is parsed by what somebody like a lawyer like John Rizzo, the CIA lawyer, would say.
We still have some U.S. journalists using the term enhanced interrogation techniques. You note that an FBI interrogator, Ali Soufan, got valuable information from Abu Zubaydah, including fingering Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but the CIA felt that he should have been getting more, so they decided to take a harder approach?
Exactly. They have.
Is that when the line was crossed?
I think that's the beginning of it, for sure. I think when they decided, when the people at the counterterrorism center, who were really monitoring everything that was going on in this part of the enterprise, when they thought, you know, both in terms of a panic that there was this second attack looming, and the complete misunderstanding by the people at the counterterrorism center about the power, that is, who was Abu Zubaydah, they really believed he was, you know, the number three at the in Al-Qaeda, which, of course, turns out to not be true at all.
So they got rid of Ali Soufan, who was getting valuable information, and then they took him through a number of stages, including what you mentioned, slapping, slamming, finally waterboarding. What did officials learn from that or conclude about the usefulness of the method?
Well, they believed, that is, there's this thing that happens at the Central Intelligence Headquarters in Langley. Every evening around 5 o'clock, there's a meeting where all the executives, George Tenet and Rizzo and many others, John Brennan, sit in the conference room, and all the people from the Counterterrorism Center come up, and they give them a blow-by-blow of what the war, if you'll excuse the expression, of what the war on terror has been during that day. And they are receiving reports up there in the seventh floor that things are going going very well with Abu Zubaydah. They're getting things now after they've gotten rid of the FBI interrogators and with these new methods, and that it's in fact so useful that they want to export it and take it to all the black sites that they're developing and use it on many other prisoners, and upstairs agrees. And that's what happens. It becomes policy for more than 100 high-value detainees.
Well, what did they finally learn from Abu Zubaydah using these methods? What role is he now believed to have played in Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think now what the Senate report says is he played a very little role. He was a logistics guy who sort of watched and kept track of people coming in and going out of the camps, but he was certainly not who they thought he was. His information was only his primary piece of information was the piece that Ali Safwan, the FBI interrogator, got from him, and that was that a guy named Mustafa was actually Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, the so-called mastermind of 9/11. So that was a great piece of information gotten by an FBI interrogator who, you know, speaks the language, understood the Quran, did the FBI, the usual FBI interrogation methods, not the intense enhanced interrogation methods of the CIA. That yielded, as far as the Senate report tells it, nothing.
And the CIA said they got a lot from him?
They did, but they didn't say what.
We will continue this conversation and talk about the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed after we take a little break. My guest is Michael Kirk, whose latest film for PBS Frontline is Secrets, Politics, and Torture. It airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country. Stay with us for more. And we're back with Michael Kirk, whose latest film is for the PBS Frontline series, is Secrets, Politics, and Torture, broadcast tomorrow night on PBS stations around the country and in New York as well. We went out talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was the architect of the 9/11 attacks. What was done to him?
Well, they, you know, there was a list of 12 things they could do. It starts with a facial grab and then goes to the walling where they throw you against the wall, and then the famous tummy tap and many other things. Very, very, very quickly with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or KSM as we'll call him in this conversation, they decide to waterboard him and they sort of basically go for it right away. So they go all the way to the bottom of the list, the worst thing there is, very, very quickly. And in the end, they end up waterboarding KSM 183 times.
And they got him to tell them things. They insisted that he provide them with Al-Qaeda plans for future attacks in the United States. He sent them to investigate a plot being hatched by African-American Muslim converts in Montana.
Yes.
Just to stop them from torturing him?
He got so good at it, at being waterboarded, that he used to, when he was laying there, it says this in the Senate report, he would do a kind of countdown when he knew they would stop. So he'd hold his hand up, you know, go 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. He was that capable as a guy who was fighting back against them. Of the many, many things that he told them, there was this sort of fabric of lies constantly coming out of him, and one of them was this super whopper about a sleeper cell that had been created out in Montana. It caused, of course, the FBI and state police to marshal and get out there and look around, and they obviously discovered that there was nothing to it. And when they went back to him and said, what the heck? He said, look, I was just trying to tell you what I thought you wanted to hear.
John McLaughlin says that he lied sometimes, but more often than not, he told the truth. Has that been the way things have turned out?
Well, it's Mr. McLaughlin and others from the Central Intelligence Agency and other supporters, the former Vice President Dick Cheney and others, say these things, of course, all of us are eager to know some specifics about what is actually what that actually means. And the Senate report, which looked at 6 million pages of that information, Senator Feinstein told us that There were some things that were said, but almost nothing that they hadn't confirmed or didn't know from other sources. So that's a kind of a, it's, I think it's a way they used to say there was nothing actionable that they ever got from him that that was useful in that sense.
Although this isn't in your film, Mohammed Salahi wrote in his book Guantanamo Diary that he was tortured to elicit information about things he couldn't have known about because they took place after he had been imprisoned.
You know, the one of the many things that would be wonderful to get at if one could access the 6,400 pages of the report that's sealed would be details like what kinds of questions they ask, when they ask, who were the people who were interrogating, you know, all of these people. I mean, there are many details that exist already, enough details to know that it was just brutal and awful. But one would want to know things like the question you just raised, Leonard, that just, you know, it just, you can just imagine what it must have been like to be grabbed by these guys. And not that these all these prisoners are choir boys by any stretch of the imagination, but the extent to which the breakdown in communication from what was being asked for and insisted upon by Langley, by headquarters, and what the people in the field were trying to get, and whether they even understood what they were trying to get, there are enough instances of that even in the smaller report that you just say, you throw your hands up and just say, my God, how did they ever believe any of this was useful?
How much of a role did James Mitchell, Bruce Jessen, and some other members of the American Psychological Association play in this change into applying these things that we're calling torture?
It is almost comical the way that they get hired. There, you know, the CIA is looking around when they realize they don't want to use the FBI interrogators. They don't have any of their own. They've never actually captured or detained or interrogated anybody in a kind of formal sense ever before. So now suddenly they know they're going to get these guys off the battlefield, this shadow enemy, the Al-Qaeda people. They're worried sick about a second attack. So they're asking around, all around the CIA building as they're ramping up the counterterrorism center, and they said, does anybody know anybody who knows anything about this? And somebody tells somebody else that there's these guys they know who are retired Air Force guys who had sort of prepared to kind of reverse engineer the psychological training that happened right after Korea, where people were, you know, were learning how to respond to the what they used to call brainwashing techniques by the that happened in North Korea.
The sort of things that John McCain had to endure.
Yes, in Vietnam, he'd had to endure horrible stuff, and they were things like, you know, burying people in a coffin for a few days and then dragging them out, and they were obviously, you know, confused and horrified, and you could talk to them, and Mitchell and Jessen, who were these two psychologists or former psychologists, former Air Force psychologists, said was that they wanted to get their interrogatees to a state called learned helplessness, which they had learned from watching of the experiments that had happened to dogs, where they got dogs not to eat even though they were starving by punishing them before they ate. And they decided that this was the state they had to bring these Al-Qaeda guys to, learned helplessness. If they could get them there by going all the way down to waterboarding, then they would perhaps get them to talk. And that was the plan as they went forward with first Abu Zubaydah and then Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and then I think the number is 119 other what they called high-value terrorists.
They'd put them in coffin-like boxes, and then they'd put them into boxes half that size, and then they'd have them stand for days. And you point out that Mitchell earned $8 million as an advisor to the CIA?
The number that the company earned, he and Jessen form a company as sort of subcontractors, which is, as we all know famously now, people do with this top secret America establishment post 9/11. And the company that Jessen and Mitchell built earned $81 million from the Central Intelligence
Agency. Oh, $81 million. Oh, that's a lot more than $8 million.
Yes, it is.
John McLaughlin, the former CIA deputy director that we mentioned earlier, he's now at Johns Hopkins University. He says, we were at war. Bad things happen in wars. Does he or any other official acknowledge any wrongdoing or recognize that the United States has laws and there are international laws that prohibit torture?
No, from almost the very beginning, something happened that basically, I think when you step back and you say, okay, now what's the big lesson here? The big lesson is, what was the first question that George Tenet, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, asked of John Rizzo? What was the first question the President of the United States asked of the Central Intelligence Agency and his attorneys? And that question was, can we do this? That's not a mechanical question, that is, can we torture people? It was a legal question, can we do this? And what Rizzo's job was for the CIA was to go out and get legal approval and answer that question. And the answer to that question, both from John Ashcroft at the Justice Department and his own attorneys, was yes, we can. Yes, we can, absolutely. I mean, no one in the Bush administration at any level, not Condoleezza Rice, not obviously Dick Cheney or anyone, said no. They all said yes, we can do this to the President of the United States and to the Central Intelligence Agency, which wanted legal authority to do it. What no one asked, the question no one asked, which is the important one from my perspective, I think, or at least an important one to have asked, which is, should we do this? And we could find no one who, including John Rizzo or John McLaughlin, who would ever ask in those 5 o'clock meetings the question, should we do this?
But he says that he realized that someday they would be, in his word, screwed.
I think if anybody knows how bad things can go, it would be members of the Central Intelligence Agency, who go all the way back to the Church Pike Committee in the 70s and even before that. They walk to the edge, and they keep thinking that they've learned their lesson and they won't go too far out on a limb, because they're the first ones that get sacrificed by politicians and others when, you know, the stuff hits the fan. They wanted all the approval they could get their hands on, and Rizzo continues to maintain that they thought they got it all, and Bush and Cheney certainly pushed for no liability for not only people at the Central Intelligence Agency, but others like Cheney and Rice, who had knowledge of the program and let it go.
Jane Mayer of The New Yorker called Elfriede Frances Bukowski the queen of torture. Has she or Rizzo or McLaughlin or Mitchell or Jessen or anyone else involved in the torture faced any consequences?
Congress passed a piece of legislation in 2006 that essentially, it hasn't been obviously tested all the way up to the Supreme Court, but essentially created no liability for anyone involved in this program.
That was right after President Bush gave that speech where he said, I want to be absolutely clear with our people and the world. The United States does not torture. It's against our laws and it's against our values. I have not authorized it and I will not authorize it. That speech came as a big surprise, you say in the film, to Condoleezza Rice, because she had expected him to say something different.
There is a fascinating subtext going on all the way through his administration from about 2004, 2005, 2006. There's a war being waged by Condoleezza Rice against Rumsfeld and against Cheney, first for the mistakes in Iraq, but also the mistakes like these kind of mistakes, like the creation of the enhanced interrogation program, et cetera, et cetera. And she believes that she can get other members of the administration by the fall of 06. They are August of 06, there's an unbelievable meeting in the Roosevelt Room at the White House where on television screens on opposite ends of the table, many of the people from his cabinet and people from the CIA, including Rizzo and Rice, are there. And then on the screens and the television screens are Cheney on one end and Rumsfeld on another, who couldn't get back to Washington for this great momentous moment where the President of the United States is going to decide, does he finally reveal to the American people what has now become a kind of, you know, dirty little secret, subterranean secret, that resulted arrested as a result of Dana Priest's stories about black sites and the Abu Ghraib stuff and all kinds of other things that are starting to come out. And she thinks she convinces Bush that he doesn't want to be known as the torture president, even though from one of the television screens at the end of the table, Cheney has made the counterargument, which is no, we shouldn't tell the American people or anybody in Washington what it is we've been doing. Bush, to everyone at the table, believes that Bush has acceded to Rice's suggestion. He sets up a meeting in the East Room where a lot of people from the government will come, the press will be there, and he will roll out to the American people what has actually been going on and say, we're going to roll this program up and close it down, we don't need it anymore, blah, blah, blah. So she's sitting there. We have a camera trained on her that we've found, and she's sitting there fully expecting that he will make this speech and close the program down, when in fact he does not. It's a full-throated defense of the program. It is a revelation of it, not in its gritty details, but of its existence. And at that same session, it's where he asked Congress for permission to go forward with the program and not have any liability for anybody in his administration or at the Central Intelligence Agency who had been involved in it.
There were videotapes of the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, we learned later that a man named Jose Rodriguez, the former director of National Clandestine Service at the CIA, had those tapes destroyed. Wasn't destruction of those tapes a violation of federal law?
Well, it might have been. Again, here's another instance where that immunity passed by the Congress covers Mr. Rodriguez as well. Rizzo told me that when he discovered that Rodriguez had destroyed or ordered the destruction of the tapes, 97 hours of videotape of Abu Zubaydah being waterboarded, as Jane Mayer told us, if 25 seconds of that on national television would have just been a disaster for the agency, and if we think the photographs from Abu Ghraib were bad, you can imagine what that would have been like. When Rizzo hears that Rodriguez has ordered the destruction, he said in all of his years at the Central Intelligence Agency, nothing had ever flabbergasted, and you could imagine the things he has heard about, nothing had ever flabbergasted him more than that.
Now, the thing has become politicized. The Senate did a full investigation of the millions of CIA documents. You mentioned that, issued a report. There was also the Leon Panetta report. Didn't every Republican in Congress refuse to read the review by Leon Panetta? And hasn't Senator Richard Burr, the Republican who is in charge of what committee?
The Intelligence Committee.
He ordered the return of the full 6,000-page report, the Senate report, that has remained classified all along. So has this become a political football?
Well, in so many more ways than we have time to talk about right now, but the answer is, of course, yes. What happened was, of course, the Senate investigates. The Senate wants to release the 6,400-page report. The Central Intelligence Agency says absolutely not. By the way, this is the Democratic Senate.
Republicans refused to go along with it.
Exactly. The Republicans said yes, and then they said no. So the investigation continues under the Democrats' aegis. It gets written under their oversight. It gets pushed, but it is a Democratic president by now, Barack Obama, who Dianne Feinstein is saying, Mr. President, help us release this. The CIA is also run by John Brennan, who had been a close associate of the president in the White House as his counterterrorism czar, and they and this battle ensues to redact it, to cut it down, to make it an executive summary, to lock it up, to keep it away. The battle just inside the Democrats alone to get Feinstein, to get Obama to go forward and allow it to come out. Brennan saying, if you do this, it'll just completely destroy, you know, what we're trying to do over here. The Senate finding the Panetta report, quote-unquote finding it in somewhere in that tranche of material that they were getting from the CIA. The CIA saying, give that back. You can't read that. It getting locked up. the Republicans refusing to read it, and then, on top of everything else, a midterm election happens last fall, and the Republicans win. Feinstein is no longer the chairman of the committee, and in her last days, compromise is worked out where the 450-page report gets released, the thing we have. But inside the Intelligence Committee's locked safe is both the Panetta review, obtained somehow by the Democrats, and the Republican chairman of the committee now says he wants to give it back to the CIA, and he refuses to read it, and so do the Republicans on the committee.
There are lots of other details that we can't get to, but the show will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. It is called Secrets, Politics, and Torture, and my great thanks to Michael Kirk, who's one of the writers and the director of this documentary, for being on our show again.
Always my pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.